This ain't no game, boppers. It's a live-action thrill ride. Oh, wait, no, it's just junk food cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Boppers, and welcome to another gravy-soaked, deep-fried episode of Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects. This is the podcast that takes a long, good look at cult and exploitation film and unleashes its affinity for even seemingly super awful flicks that have hooked us. We also represent Doomsday for ironic film appreciation. I am your host, Brian Salisbury. Hello. And I am joined by my friend and co-host, novelist
Herber.
Yeah, I don't know what.
Hi, everybody.
Those words were supposed to be novelist and screenwriter, and now I realize why I usually say screenwriter first. Apparently, my tongue cannot handle the other arrangement. So, C. Robert Cargill, hello.
Hi.
Sorry about that.
I'm glad your tongue can't handle my arrangements. That makes me a very happy man.
I'm so happy to be doing this show with you right now. And you
at this moment.
You can find this very amazing show on iTunes if you just search for Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section. You can also find us on Stitcher. We are on Twitter for you to follow at Junk Food Cinema. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. A very sad note serves as our catalyst today. The great Bob Hoskins has departed our dimension. A lot of you probably know actor Bob Hoskins from his roles in things like this little movie, this little cartoon called Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which I feel like has a following of some sort.
Yeah, and the smash hit Spice World. Or wait, I think those are backwards.
I don't know. I think you slammed it to the left when you should have slammed it to the right, but I see you.
Kick it to the front. All right.
Jesus.
Don't take me there.
No,
I will Spice World.
No, I know you will.
Circles around you, motherfucker.
But that's too much of something. It may not be enough, but that's too much of this thing. Anyway, I didn't think we would talk about the Spice Girls on our Bob Hoskins retrospective, and I feel like that's not the appropriate way to honor this man.
But a Spice Girl was so cool that she turned into Bob Hoskins at a point in the movie.
That's
just
true.
For the point to show Bob Hoskins, because that's how cool he was.
Yes, yes. That is the paradigm of his cool. You know, and
when you can show up in a movie, you know, and just utter one word like that, and that's the whole reason they bring you in, because they know everyone in the audience is gonna fucking geek out over it. Yeah, you've gotten to a pretty cool fucking level, and that was Bob fucking Hoskins.
And, you know, Roger Rabbit, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, obviously is a work of genius, and it's what I love most about it. We're not gonna talk too much about it, because I feel like everybody knows Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But what I do love about it is the fact that it makes a very grown-up and seedy film noir with a lot of kids' cartoon characters, which I think is why a lot of people have mistakenly thought, oh, that's a kids' movie. It's really not a kids' movie if you watch.
No.
Like, the whole thing about him taking photographs of Jessica Rabbit, quote-unquote, playing patty cake, and all you hear is moaning from, like, come on. How is this a kids' movie? Give me a break. It is a hard-boiled detective at the end of his rope. It's everything we loved about, you know, like Philip Marlowe stories. It just happens to also have Mickey Mouse and
Daffy versus Donald.
Yeah, that dueling piano fight is amazing. But also, I mean, Hook is another movie I think a lot of people will probably be talking about, because it's another movie people are very familiar with, and a character that they're very familiar with Bob Hoskins playing is Smee in Hook. So those two movies are great. We're not debating that. But we wanted to focus tonight in our Hoskins retrospective on the films that I feel like don't get enough love.
Like Spice World.
Apparently like Spice World, just right out of the gate with Spice World. So this is obviously...
Let's get it out of the way so it's done.
Yeah, starting off on the right foot for sure. I think they use meters over there. The point is, Bob Hoskins, I'm going to go ahead and start
really
with...
You're going to start off in the right meter over in the UK?
You started off with Spice Girls, dude. I like weigh it. Weigh it in pounds. Anyway, Long Good Friday is the first film I actually want to talk about, because this is a movie that kind of put Bob Hoskins on the map and definitely created the Bob Hoskins gangster persona. He would play a number of gangsters in British films, some of which made it over to the States, some of which did not. But The Long Good Friday really set the standard. This is a film that was released in 1980 and is about a gangster in London named Harold, who is in the midst of creating this deal with the American Mafia to kind of create an international crime syndicate, or at least an international crime connection. As this deal is going on, there's all these bombings and people in Harold's organization are getting killed. And so it's kind of putting the damper on this deal. And so the American Mafia kind of comes off as having their shit together, whereas the British gangster Harold has obviously let things run amok. But what the movie's about is this one day, or this one weekend, Long Good Friday weekend, where it's not long weekend because then they would be in the Australian.
It's a long Easter weekend. Long Easter weekend. They call it the Long Good Friday, even though the third act takes place on Saturday.
True. But so his people are getting killed, his establishments are getting bombed, he has no idea who's behind this, and it's a scramble that he's scrambling to figure this out before this deal goes sour. Yeah, I love the hell out of this movie. It's just quintessential gangster cinema.
I like it. It's an interesting film. It's one of those weird films that this is the only really good film that this director made.
Definitely.
And he makes a lot of mistakes in this movie. There's a lot of just really kind of amateur decisions that get made. And the screenplay is weird. It's structured crazily. So much so that the audience has no idea in the first act what the hell is going on the first time you watch it. Like, you don't know if these people are gangsters. You don't know if they're con men. You don't know if they're actual businessmen trying to pull a scam. And they actually reveal that he's a gangster in the second act, which is really great. But the thing is that the performances in this movie are so powerful, and all of that information that slowly gets leaked out to you informs you on the first act for a rewatch that it elevates the movie in such a way that it's one of those movies that you kind of want to bring up to other screenwriters, especially young screenwriters, and go, this is where you break all the rules, and this is how you can make it work when you break all the rules.
Sure.
And it's really interestingly done, but the performances are unreal. I mean, we mentioned Bob Hoskins, of course, but who's Bob Hoskins playing against in this? Helen Mirren. And in her prime, and she is just amazing. And there's all this great cast of British actors all playing hoods, some of whom are recognizable. There's even a James Bond in there as an Irish assassin.
Yeah, it's the first on-screen role for Pierce Brosnan.
And he's adorable. He's this baby-faced little boy, and it's like, oh my God, it's baby James Bond.
And he's going to kill you.
He just want to pinch his cheeks. And
then he'll stab you.
And then he will stab you terribly. No, he's like, he doesn't have a single line in this movie, but he is the two major scenes that he's in the movie. He has such a presence, like you can see that at such an early age. And then there's just a couple other cameo appearances by other actors where you're like, oh, holy shit, it's that guy. And it's all these great British character actors that flesh this film out, and it's just a performance film, because it really, there's not a lot that happens in the movie, but you're riveted the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, that's the crazy thing about this. He's in the middle of a war he didn't know he was a part of.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so interesting about that character, is he does seem like on a certain level he's trying to not necessarily go straight, but get into more legitimate ventures, and just he's trying to be more of a businessman. And it's kind of that Godfather 3 thing. It's like, just when he thought he was out, people are pulling him back in. And it's sort of him unraveling the mystery along with the audience of who these people are and why they're doing this to him. And Bob Hoskins, you're right, his performance in this, he's, you know, he's a growly, vicious bulldog of a gangster suffering from a major Napoleonic complex. Like, everything he does in this movie is about, like, I'm bigger than you are, even if our heights don't communicate that, I'm bigger than you are.
Well, I love the, you know, my favorite moment with him in this film is the one where it's the first time we really get a sense of who he is and what he's done. And he's like, look, this guy, Colin would never hurt a fly. And then everybody just kind of turns and looks at him. And he goes, well, he never hurt a fly that didn't have it coming.
Yeah. And it's like, he had to do some murders, but they were always clean. They were never excessive. Yeah.
We've had 10 years of peace, you know, and it's not like we really hurt anybody to get here. Not anybody that didn't have it coming. And it's just you see how deluded he is.
Right.
And that's what I think is so interesting about this film, and why I think that first act plays the way it does, because he's really trying. and presenting himself as an upstanding businessman, even though the little whispers here and there lend you to think that they're pulling some kind of a con. And really, they're not. They're not conning anybody. They're just trying to secure a business deal because he wants to move legit. He wants to – he actually sees the future. He's this guy who sees, you know, London becoming the financial center of Europe as it would then become.
Right.
And he was taking, you know, trying to get a piece of that so that, you know, his future was protected and it wasn't about, you know, small scraps. He wanted to be the guy running London. And he's got this huge ambition and he's presenting himself as so legit because he believes and has convinced himself that he's legit. But as the movie goes on, you realize this guy, there's nothing good about him. Yeah. There's nothing redeeming about him. There's nothing nice or likable about him. He's a total scumbag, and he's fascinating. And then we get to that great scene in the meat plant.
Yeah, it's a scene that I feel like if you know anything about this movie, you know this scene. Because basically, as he's making inquiries into who it is that's bombing and who it is that's killing all his people, he brings in pretty much every gangster in London, suspends them upside down, and pulls them through an entire, you know, meatpacking plant upside down on these hooks to question them. But they literally go from the truck through several rooms upside down on this track system, and it's incredible. It's an incredible scene.
For more than 10 years, there's been peace. I've put money in all your pockets. I've treated you lot well, even when you was out of order, right? Well, now there's been an eruption.
Yeah, and then he has this great scene right outside. They step outside to have a conversation, and someone comes a bit clean with him, and then he just kind of has it out. And it's it's the turning point of the movie, and it's just – it's so good. And then, of course, that it rides on through to the final moments, and you get that last scene car, which is just – It's pure Hopkins.
Yeah.
And he has one line in the movie. He has one line in that final scene. And then through cinematography, we find out everything else. And it just cuts back to a shot of him. And we see him go through about half a dozen different emotions in those moments.
I would say that, 5 stages of a certain emotion.
Perhaps. Yeah. And it's so well done, and it's so well, amazingly well acted. Yeah. It is. I would, as much as everyone else is going to talk about Roger Rabbit and Hook, I think leading off this way, this is the performance of his career.
Definitely.
There's no Bob Hoskins better than the Bob Hoskins in The Long Good Friday.
And I really do think, I mean, as somebody who is kind of obsessed with mafia movies, this performance, this role, is one of my favorite cinematic gangsters. I love Harold in this film. I think he's perfect because he does sort of embody both. He's that thug. I mean, he's absolutely a thug. It's kind of the same conundrum or the same paradox with somebody like Al Capone, because Al Capone was, you know, the short, fat, he was a total thug, and yet at the same time, he always, like, thought of himself as a forward-thinking businessman, and he did some things, you know, nefarious though they may be, he definitely made some shrewd business moves, but at the same time, that thug was always there, and you just needed to wake that sleeping giant to find out, and that's exactly what this movie is. It's another faction waking a sleeping giant and finding out exactly how ruthless this guy is. But at the same time, like, his anger just keeps being directed toward the wrong people and ultimately, you know, becomes sort of hubris. And I love thematically even, I love this film. But one of the things I really love about this film is the score, which is sort of this, like, jazzy goblin pool party. Like, is the only way I could think to describe it, because it sounds very much like an Italian film. Like, you feel like you're going to be watching like the early scenes of lesser known Fulci or something. Like, mm-hmm. it has that same texture to it.
Well, it's very clearly ADR'd, most of it.
Yeah,
except for, of course, Hopkins' performances. You know, a lot of the dialogue scenes are clearly done with sound, but so much of the movie is done wild with that or without wild sound, with just ADR, and it has those exact same sound effects, and it's got that that weird ADR dialogue put into the backgrounds, mm-hmm. and then it's got this powerful score over over silently shot scenes. And yeah, it is just out there and in your face and dated as hell to where you could set your watch to the day and time that score was made. And yet it's so amazing and so its own thing.
Definitely. And this was so early in Hopkins' career that initially they actually dubbed all of his lines because they were afraid that American audiences wouldn't be able to understand him. Because if you've ever seen Bob Hoskins in a film, you know he's got this very specific type of cadence and this very like gravelly timbre to him. And it's one of the things that I kind of wish that I had had the opportunity to have Bob Hoskins like leave a message on my voicemail or something. He's just got one of those great
voices.
If
you think you can keep a
it's just like the angrier he gets, the more the gravel is just rolling around in the back of his throat. And I love that about him.
There are some lines that are hard to understand. There was moments where my wife and I had to, you know, when we were watching this, we had to go back and my wife was looking at me and like, what the hell did he just say? And I'm like, I don't even know.
Well, it's twofold. It's his voice and it's just a preponderance of Cockney gangster slang.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you're right. Like, it may cause an issue the first time you watch it. But as Cargo said, this is a movie that really kind of demands reviewing.
Going back, I want to address one of the things you were talking about in comparing this to other gangster movies. The interesting thing where I was going, you know, when I started out talking about this, is that what they don't do here that they do in every other gangster movie is there is no scene here where they try to humanize him at all.
No.
You know, there's no wedding scene. There's no, like, American Gangster, which is one of my favorite gangster movies, where Denzel Washington has these scenes with his mother and you see what a good son he is. And they give you these things to like and understand why people like him. And here, they're like, no, he's not a good dude. You're not supposed to like him. He is fucking awful, and you are going to watch him do awful things to everyone around him. And the only reason, you know, the nicest he is to this grieving widow who's like screaming at him, who he has to slap. And then he's like, well, what do you want? She's like, I need at least 100 quid a week. He's like, oh, done.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Yeah, but this
and here, get a proper headstone for your husband and send me the bill. Like that's as nice as he gets, is agreeing to give a small pittance to a widow and pay for the
headstone. For the headstone. But it's only as polite as something like Sonny Corleone breaking the photographer's camera and then throwing the money on the ground.
Yeah.
Like it's not even necessarily a nice thing that he does. It's just something that's almost like dutiful.
Yeah.
As the leader of this gang, you know, this guy was one of his gangsters who's been killed, his widow. Obviously, he's got to take care of her, but it's so much more of a duty than it is anything he feels compelled to do out of the kindness of his heart. And yeah, this is a devil you will feel no sympathy for at any point during the film. That doesn't mean you're not going to like him, because I certainly do.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Oh, no. As a character, he's fascinating, but he's not likable. You
not
don't like him. You are fascinated by him.
Yeah, maybe that's more apt, but still,
In the same way, people don't like Darth Vader, but Darth Vader's awesome. Yeah, well, he is. He's
kind of like Darth Vader.
No, you don't.
I kind of do. The other thing I love about Helen Mirren in this movie is that originally her role was written as much more of a traditional gangster moll, just arm candy. And she insisted that they write her as a more complex character. And she is much more of like a consigliere than she is a moll.
Yeah.
And I really love that. Like even in early, you know, this was filmed in 1979. It was released in 1980. And even then, even at that time, in a gangster movie, no less, they're creating this really strong female character who is kind of on par with our protagonist, because she is every bit as business savvy, and her advantage is that she knows how to sweet talk people, and it's perfect. And she's perfect in this role.
But she also what's great is she also has her shit together. There's that great scene where Bob Hoskins is coming unraveled, and you just see him. He can't even see straight. He can't focus his eyes, and he's covered in blood, and she's just like, look, go take a shower. Chill the fuck out.
Yeah.
We'll take care of this. And the way she just handles him and manages him, you get that scene, you get a wide perspective on what their relationship is.
Definitely.
That's really great.
Well, Long Good Friday is what we started with, and that's one of my favorites for sure. But I know one of Cargill's favorites is a movie called Doomsday.
Yes.
This is a Neil Marshall film from 2008 that you're probably scratching your head and going, what's Doomsday? Yeah, it didn't get much of a play in the States as far as you know, people latching onto it. But Cargill, tell us about Doomsday.
Well, Doomsday has a rather dubious place in history, in that it was a film Neil pitched to Universal. They bought it. They wanted to make it, and what it was it was his Grindhouse. And he wanted to make his version of Grindhouse, where, you know, Tarantino and Rodriguez are a bit older than guys like me and Neil, and they grew up with 70s exploitation in their childhood, and we grew up with 80s exploitation, and that's what we grew up with. And Neil wanted to make a film that was about the movies that affected him in his childhood and made him want to make movies, which were, of course, Mad Max, Excalibur, Escape from New York, you know, movies that you see posters of nonstop over at Brian's house.
Yes,
it was essentially Brian's childhood, you know, Brian's adulthood rediscovering his childhood.
Yeah.
And so he made this film. Well, while he was in the process of making this film, Grindhouse flopped. Weinstein's released it on Easter weekend. It got its ass handed to it because nobody goes and sees rated R movies on Easter weekend. Instead, it got handed to its ass handed to it by the sequel to Are We There Yet?
I'm sorry, if you don't see the obvious crucifixion story metaphor in Quentin Tarantino getting his dick ripped off, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how to explain this to you any clearer.
But so essentially, what he was making was an action comedy, and at the same time, he ended up getting. He ended up getting saddled with a situation where he ended up with an actor that wasn't exactly the actor that he wanted. And that actress ended up not nailing the comedy aspects of her character. And the result is a movie that misfired for audiences because Universal sold it as a very serious post-apocalyptic science fiction movie, yeah. Which it is not. It is a tongue-in-cheek post-apocalyptic science fiction movie that is fun as hell, that's meant to be taken as an exploitation film as opposed to being taken as a serious entry into sci-fi.
Here's one red flag for you going and watching this to know that is entirely the case, is that the two soldiers who go in to Scotland are named Miller and Carpenter after George Miller and John Carpenter.
Yes. Yeah, no, this entire movie, you know, is something that is not meant to be taken seriously. It's meant to be taken as exploitation in the same way that exploitation from the era was riffing on, you know, exploitation from other eras. You know, that's exploitation is cyclical like that. And we had just reached a point where people were accepting meta films as real films, but then the big meta film experiment failed. And so you have this film that many of you may have watched, but watched thinking it was a serious film and like, well, it was kind of okay. Some of the things didn't work and they seem kind of silly. And then all of a sudden it's Excalibur. I don't understand what's going on. And that was a complaint I heard from a lot of people. And it's like, no, it was actually Excalibur. That was the point. You know, he was mashing up his genres and having fun with it. And that's all this is. It's a fun, silly genre mashup with some really badass scenes in it. There's the action scenes, the chase scene at the end of the movie is really phenomenal. You know, the basic premise is there's, you know, a sci-fi virus in the future that wipes out a bunch of people. So they build a huge wall to wall off Scotland where it took place and put everybody over there. And then all of a sudden you've got zombies running around doing their things while everybody else is kind of living on the other side of the wall, happy as can be. Well, then everybody over there dies, supposedly. And then all of a sudden, satellites start picking up life and start picking up communities. And so they send over a team of people to escape from New York style to go in and find out what's going on. And that's the setup of the film that then takes us through a whole host of early 80s exploitation classics.
So the one thing we haven't mentioned so far is who Bob Hoskins plays in Doomsday.
Well, he's the guy that sends sends Rhona Mitra, you know, aka female Snake Plissken.
So he's the Lee Van Cleef of the movie.
Yeah, he's just like, yeah, you need to go on this mission and do this thing. And he lends all his Bob Hoskininess to the Bob Hoskiny role. I mean, the reason we're mentioning this is one of those good, entertaining movies that fits our mold that we should. We were going to talk about this movie one day, one way or another.
Yeah, it was going to come up.
And this is just the saddest way that this could come up, yeah, is by losing, you know, Bob Hoskins. But yeah, it's a very small role. But the minute he shows up, you're just like, oh shit, it's Bob Hoskins. And he does a great job. And then we send, you know, Rhona Mitra and her team off on this mission. And then it's, you know, Escape from New York at that point. But yeah, it's very Lee Van Cleef. Or who is the one who did it in Escape from L.A.? Wasn't it Stacey Keach?
Stacey Keach, yep.
And yeah, and it's that role. It's, you've seen a number of guys play that. You go and you get a legend to step in and play that role. So you buy it, and then they were there. It worked for a day, and people are like, oh yeah, Bob Hoskins is that in that movie, yeah. And that's what this is.
Well, but that's one of the great things about Bob Hoskins is, you know, people pointed out that in addition to some really great films, he was in some really terrible films. And that's true. But what was great about Bob Hoskins is there is not a bad Bob Hoskins performance to be found.
No, that's – and he's part of that, you know, that working class actor thing in the UK, along with people like
Michael Caine.
Yeah, Michael Caine in particular. You know, guys who grew up and felt – fortunate that they were able to work every day and have a job that they could go to and have a job where they were in demand. And so they worked and they always brought it. And veteran character actors like that. I mean, that's why we're talking about Hoskins today, because Hoskins really was that guy. He always brought it. Even in bad movies, even in disregarded movies, you never get that impression from him that this wasn't that anything was beneath him. He walked into Doomsday and he gave Neil everything he had.
Yeah,
I mean, and you just you're like, oh, there it is. It's, you know, it's not the okay, what's my line, going whatever the fuck that is. That's go there. That'll work. It's he really brings it, and he brings it in so many other films that you would think are beneath him, and that's what's so great about him. And and that's one of the things I love about this film is you really see everybody going for it in this movie, even though they know that it's meta, mm-hmm. even though they know that it is just grindhouse, you know, early 80s spectacle goodness. Everybody's like really giving it. And that's why I think so many people get confused by it, because it's not like Machete, where while you're watching it, you know, everybody's kind of mugging for the camera and you see just how goofy and over the top it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
This movie feels like if it weren't smashing up these things, it actually might be a really good movie on its own without having to be meta.
And it sounds like, you know, movies like Machete are, the problem with them is they're too self-aware. And they venture into that, you know, that thing we talk about all the time about the difference between showing affinity and being ironic. Whereas Doomsday, it seems like its chief problem is that it wasn't really that aware of itself. Like what it should have been and what it should have been allowed to have been would have been a completely different film if the studio hadn't gotten involved. So its problem is almost that it's not aware enough of itself.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on to our next film on the list, which is Unleashed. Now we're getting back to the Bob Hoskins gangster persona. This is a 2005 martial arts film directed by Louis Leterrier, who also did The Incredible Hulk, who also did Clash of the Titans remake, who also did Now You See Me, and it was written by Luc Besson. And this was 2005, so Luc Besson hadn't gone like fully off the rails yet. He was still very much somebody whose name would show up, you know, on the cover of something, and we'd get very excited. But Unleashed hit right in that sweet spot, and the combination of him and Leterrier is so perfect for this film. It's about a gangster who basically raises this young Chinese boy to be his attack dog, and literally, like, makes him wear a collar. He sleeps in a cage under the floor, and
the movie over outside of the U.S. is titled Danny the Dog.
Danny the Dog.
Well, you basically turned a man into a dog.
How did you do that?
Like my saint of a mum used to say, get him young, the possibilities are endless.
But he's basically raised as this killing machine, and he's a supreme martial artist. And every time his handler, played by Bob Hoskins, takes this collar off and says, get him, he's a force of nature. Like, there's going to be nothing left standing after Jet Li, who plays this guy. After Jet Li gets done, there's no one left standing, and then the collar goes back on, and he's this sweet, docile, and incredibly empathetic, you know, basically man-child.
Yeah.
And that's the premise of the film. Now, what I like so much about Unleashed is the martial arts in this film are absolutely superb, and they combine in a way that I hadn't seen since, I believe it was Twin Warriors was the film that he did, that Jet Li did, where it combines like very static shot, very brutal hand-to-hand combat with a smidge of wire work. There's not a lot of wire work,
no.
But there's just enough to kind of make him seem like he is able to accomplish these incredible feats. And I really like that about it. And I love all of the fight scenes in this movie.
Well, this is easily one of the best Jet Li movies of all time.
Abso-freaking-lutely.
I hesitate to say that it's the best.
It's his best performance.
Yes.
For
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. There's a handful of other of his early films or mid films, if you will, that I think might actually be better than this, but it is among his very best, and it's the best English language film he made by far. For anything better than this, you have to go to his straight Hong Kong stuff.
Mm.
But it is just a fantastic movie, and it works because of three big performances. I would say four performances, because the little girl is really great and really does sell it. The young woman.
Yeah.
But you have Morgan Freeman providing playing Ray Charles essentially. You know, I wouldn't even say Ray Charles.
No, I'm just kidding.
There's just this character just has so much, such a kind soul and is so gentle and is just so lovable. And he's the happily ever after that's offered to Danny the dog when Danny the dog ends up escaping.
Yeah.
And
he's also playing a role that I think we all would like to believe Morgan Freeman is that guy in real life.
Yeah.
He's that sweet.
Yeah, and it's one of those classic Morgan Freeman doesn't have to try too hard because this is the kind of role we always see him in, and he's fantastic in it, and he does great. And then on the opposite side of that, you have Bob Hoskins, who is just an evil motherfucker. Like he's far more violent and far more aggressive than the gangster from Long Good Friday.
Yeah,
like this is a guy who doesn't fuck with anyone, and he takes Danny around for deals, and when things don't go his way, he takes the collar off Danny, and once the collar's off, all that primitive training has just, you know, and he becomes, as the American title is, unleashed.
Yeah.
And you take the leash off, and then all of a sudden he just kills everyone. And then Bob Hoskins just, you know, kind of smiles and laughs and calls Danny over and puts the collar back on, and then Danny's good again and is ready to be happy. And it's really such a great film because of that, because you really do see they play it so well in laying out these two worlds. And, you know, this living like a dog in a cage with a leash on, and then living in a home with, you know, a girl and with, you know, who's effectively a sister, and a character who's effectively a father, and getting that happily ever after, that you really see what's going on in his stunted childish head.
Mm-hmm.
And you really do get that feeling. And then, of course, there's those great moments where, you know, he's just so protective of the collar because he doesn't want to take the collar off because he's terrified of what happens when the collar comes off.
Yeah, he's afraid of his own nature, essentially.
And it's just, it's so well done. And it's one of Luc Besson's best scripts. It's up there with The Professional in terms of just how great of material it is.
And also in terms of finding the pathos in characters that are traditionally not likable or traditionally bad guys. And I'm definitely not talking about Bob Hoskins' character for sure. There's nothing really redeemable about Bart. But what I find interesting is that the script you mentioned was written for Morgan Freeman and was written for Jet Li. But Albert Finney was supposed to play the gangster initially, but he had to drop out to do Big Fish. So I'm really, really happy that circumstances kind of came together as they needed to get Bob Hoskins in this role, because it is such a – even though he's kind of got a similar presence as Harold from The Long Good Friday – these could not be two more different gangsters.
You know, it's interesting because it feels very much – like a Warren Beatty Kill Bill situation where you have this you see Albert Finney in that role and you see how Albert Finney would have nailed that role. But, you know, then, you know, what happened with Warren Beatty is Warren Beatty kept getting told by Tarantino, OK, I want you to do it just like David Carradine. And he's like, well, why the fuck don't you get David Carradine? And so he got David Carradine and David Carradine just became it was just, OK, do it like you would do it. Bam. And he was Bill.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the Warren Beatty or Albert Finney versions of that in the Alterniverse, as we are prone to talk about,
yeah.
if those movies are nearly as good. Because I think it's what it feels like, well, who the hell do we get to replace Albert Finney? Well, Bob Hoskins is available. Why did you say so? This was a Bob Hoskins movie to begin with.
Definitely. It definitely was. And speaking of people I really admire, I didn't realize until my most recent viewing that Scott Atkins is actually in this movie.
Yeah.
Scott Atkins from Undisputed 3. He was in Expendables 2. He's in Ninja. Like, this is a guy that you should probably get to know because he's a great martial artist. But he's in the movie in, like, the Battle Royale sequence near the end, which is fucking phenomenal.
Yes, it is.
And has the movie's single longest static shot, and it's all great, and it's just – I watch this movie and take a deep sigh of relief because it reminds me that not all modern action movies have to be edited on a fucking sewing machine. I hate overcutting. I hate overcutting in movies more than I would in an emo girlfriend. That's all I'm saying. And in this movie, they actually do have long shots where you're able to see, you know, expertly choreographed and relentlessly rehearsed martial arts sequences as opposed to throw one punch, cut to the next shot, throw a kick, cut to the next shot.
Look, you know, you cut on yourself like 3 or 4 times, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
But that's because I'm trying to open beers with my flesh when the bottle opener isn't available.
No, it's great. It has those... That's what's so good. I mean, this is during this period where Luc Besson was really, really being heavily influenced by what was going on over in Asia. He was not just Hong Kong, but in Thailand. And he's... Luc Besson is the guy who saw Ong Bak Muay Thai Warrior and said, oh my God, we need to release this to the rest of the world, but this ADR is terrible, so we just need to go and re-ADR the whole film. So he oversaw the new sound mix of Ong Bak and released it as Ong Bak, and that's how you guys know who Tony Jaa is.
True.
And he was being influenced by a lot of this stuff, and one of the things that you were seeing in Hong Kong and you were seeing in Thailand were these static shots because, well, it's expensive to move the camera, and it's expensive to move the camera while you've got everyone else moving, so it's easier to have the stuntmen know exactly where the camera is the whole time and choreograph, but that you also get to show the martial arts, which is why so many of the people are coming to this. And when you have amazing artists like martial artists like Jet Li, who at his prime was one of the, if not the fastest man on earth when it came to kicks and punches. He was at that peak level of excellence in his prime. And he still, Danny the Dog is one of the last, Unleashed is one of the last movies that he really was in that kind of shape. And that's when he started stepping back and doing more stuff with choreography and doing, you know, movies that didn't involve as much intensity.
Yeah.
But he left everything on the fucking field with Danny the Dog. I mean, it is just fantastic. Everything about this movie works. There's not a single moment in this movie that I dislike. I absolutely love everything about it.
You know, Bob Hoskins could have played this gangster role completely one-dimensionally. He could have played it, you know, just for, you know, tropes and just because he, you know, knowing that he's not necessarily the focus of the film. And yet he, again, like we were saying before, he throws himself into this role. He really is just like, this seems like a character that is in his marrow. And I love that about Bob Hoskins because that's every character he plays. You never get the sense that he's doing something just for the paycheck. And in fact, in Unleashed, one of the things that he did to kind of get more into the characters, he actually cut Jet Li's hair. It's not a scene in the movie. It's just something they did beforehand because that's something his handler, who had raised him to be a killing machine, would do.
Yeah.
So before the movie even started, he actually cut Jet Li's hair, having no, you know, experience as a barber. It's just, you know, that's why he's got that sort of lopsided haircut at the beginning of the film. And it's just another one of those touches where it's like when you hire Bob Hoskins, you don't get somebody who's going to sleepwalk through the movie. No matter what the role is, big or small, whether the movie is good or bad, he is going to throw himself into the role. And that was tested the most with the next film we're going to talk about. Now, before we get into this, I want to throw out this caveat. I'm not necessarily defending this movie.
Oh, I know what we're talking about.
Not necessarily defending this
movie. But you're defending this movie.
I personally
like it.
Enjoy it. I do. I will make no bones about that. But I feel like there are certain things that are contextually very fascinating about Super Mario Brothers. Which,
there it is.
If you know anything about Bob Hoskins, is the movie he hated the most of anything he did in his entire career. He loathed this film. And in fact, it's one of those instances where very early on in the film, he realized, oh, this is going to be a piece of shit. He had no idea it was based on a video game until his son told him when they were into production and just decided, well, I still have to do it, but I'm going to get drunk. So he spent a good deal of the production drunk. But even still, the rest of the movie is a total shit show. I will grant you that. But Bob Hoskins is still impossibly amiable as Mario. And despite the fact that he is from England, had a very convincing Brooklyn accent, which in and of itself is very difficult to pull off. But I want to talk a little bit more about kind of the story behind Super Mario Brothers, because it was directed by this husband and wife team who approached the film as we're going to make an adult action movie. And the studio was like, no, you're fucking not. It's based on Super Mario Brothers, the video game. You're going to make a kids film. So those two conflicting sensibilities is why the film has the most awkward tone of anything from the 90s. Not only that, it has the dubious honor of being the very first film based on a video game and setting the precedent for all of the shit shows that would follow.
Yeah.
And it remains to this day.
It opened the door to Double Dragon.
It did. To Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Yeah, but Mortal Kombat's actually good.
Oh, well, we'll get there. We'll have a whole show about video game movies. I have no doubt about that.
No, because we like to talk about stuff we like.
Well, you just said you liked Mortal Kombat, go on.
And Mortal Kombat stands as the best video game movie ever made, and there is a big gap there.
Yeah, it's a very medium film, and it's still the best video game movie ever
made. And that was, but of course, keep in mind that, you know, this era that this came from, video games didn't really have much of a story. They had a basic setup that explained why you were doing whatever it is you were doing. And sometimes you didn't even have that, you know.
Most of Mario's story was your princess is in another castle.
That was it. The base story of Super Mario Brothers was, you know, his girlfriend, the princess, was kidnapped by Bowser and taken off, and this plumber has to find his girlfriend.
Yeah, you know, let's talk about that for a second. So speaking of tonally imbalanced, so it takes place in this fantasy world of monsters and princesses and magic mushrooms, and the plumber is the guy who has to, like, the plumber from the blue collar world that we know is the one who has to save the princess of this complete fantasy world. This is already a tonally confused video game. So you can imagine, like, when it comes time to make the movie, they add another layer of confusion to this.
Now, hold on. We were invested in Mario at the time. Keep in mind that Super Mario Brothers was the sequel to Mario Brothers, which was a game based on a character that came from Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
So we were, this was our third Mario game. So you keep in mind that we were deeply invested in Mario with all the deep story we've gotten.
Let's talk about this deep story for a second. So he starts off as a guy who has to recover princesses from apes on construction sites, not really plumbing necessarily, but on construction sites. Then he gets a game where he and his brother are fighting each other, going through pipes to collect coins.
Yes.
And then when he gets his own game, it's a plumber who is pulled into a fantasy world to, again, save this princess. But even still, just all over the place. But the chief problem with the movie, ironically, is that it creates a world that works like Super Mario Brothers, but doesn't look like Super Mario Brothers.
It's science fiction.
It strips away that cutesy fantasy world and sews into its aesthetic, like, logistical things that function the same way things do in the games. But they fail to realize that what people really liked about those games was the look of it, was that sort of like fantasy aspect of it. So when you create this, like, it's like a blue collar, industrial, paradimensional sci-fi story. And then you try to like shoehorn elements of Super Mario Brothers into that. It doesn't work.
Well, what year?
93.
The
same year, by the way, as Jurassic Park, and it plays up very limited amounts of dinosaur mythology from the Mario universe. In fact, the only one, unless, I mean, I don't think, I would not qualify Bowser as a dinosaur, but Yoshi apparently is a dinosaur who's a character that had just shown up on the Super Nintendo in Super Mario World in 1991. So this was a fairly new character to Mario canon, and yet they took that dinosaur and made pretty much the entire movie about dinosaurs. And just had the unfortunate distinction of coming out the same year as one of the best dinosaur movies ever made.
Well, this brings up an important point. And this is something that, you know, nobody really talks about. But the late 80s, like 88, 89, up through the early 90s, 93 being the last year, and being the kind of the last gasps of it, was a total shit show for movies.
True.
It was a time when movies were in search of themselves. We were trying to figure out what the next thing was. We had gone from, you know, the exploitation of the 70s while exploitation was going on, we also had this amazing film movement of all these just the major voices, coming out of the woodwork and changing the way we watch movies. But two of those voices, Spielberg and Lucas, created the summer blockbuster. And so we started moving into the summer blockbuster era, and in the early 80s, we really saw that, and we saw that amazingly. And 84 is where we saw it both be awesome and incredible and make some of the greatest movies of all time, i.e. Ghostbusters, and then also really awful. And unfortunately, we spun off into this weird kind of awful zone where good movies did come out of the system, but they just kind of kept getting worse and worse for a while. Yep. And we hit this era where it was really bad and everybody wanted something new. And in 92 was when we saw the indie explosion. And that's where all of a sudden Rodriguez and Tarantino and Richard Linklater and all of those voices of the 90s emerged all at once.
The new film brats,
you know, the indie movement. And that fundamentally changed the way we were making movies again. But there's this period, and Super Mario Brothers is one of those films that stands as a hallmark for what that entire era felt like. Sometimes smaller films, brilliant filmmakers, would eke out really good stuff. And then you have stuff like, you know, Spielberg turning out two of the biggest films of his career in that era with Schindler's List and
Jurassic Park.
But there's so much else in that era that's just bad. That's, you know, everybody grasping at straws and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And a lot of it were failures. And this was my high school era, unfortunately. So for me at that period of time, you know, when a James Cameron movie came out, you fucking went, you know, 10 p.m. the night before the movie was fully out to see that first screening because you knew you were finally going to see something awesome again. But like Terminator 2's in that era. But there's so much bad stuff. And this is one of those movies. And I can't defend this in any way, shape, or form.
I'm going to try to. Because separate from the actual Mario stuff, I am kind of intrigued by the sci-fi story. It's the supposition that the meteor that destroyed the dinosaurs actually shifted them into a separate dimension from mammals, and therefore they were able to follow their own evolutionary path. Now, bear in mind, not a shred of this would hold up to even the most casual scientific scrutiny. But if I were to read a short story that kind of put forth the idea that dinosaurs had their own evolutionary track that somehow still led them to being, you know, humanoid type beings, I would be like, okay, I'm kind of engaged by this. This is interesting. But unfortunately, that is used as the platform for a movie based on a video game where a plumber jumps on turtles.
Yeah.
And it makes no fucking sense. And apparently there were daily rewrites. Daily.
This
on
doesn't
this film.
Surprise me.
On this film, there were this was a total, when I say shit show, I mean all the way down the ladder. Apparently, the director of photography was fired after a couple weeks, and they brought in actually a DP that we've talked about before because he shot Razorback. And he was brought in, and after a couple weeks, he called the original DP and said, "I regret taking this job." This actually happened. I mean, it was, you know, and Hoskins has stated several times. In fact, he was interviewed before he died about this movie, and he said that this husband and wife team just had no idea what they were doing, and it was a total catastrophe. And
is it their only film?
No, they did not. They didn't direct a single feature film. after this. But one of the things I find really fascinating about the story of the Super Mario Brothers movie is that, do you know who was originally offered the job to direct this film? Harold Ramis. Harold Ramis was initially offered Super Mario Brothers, and he turned it down. And of course he turned it down. It's not a movie. You know, it's not a subject matter that he would necessarily be interested in. But I keep coming back to this idea of a Super Mario Brothers movie where Bill Murray is King Koopa, and I can't help but love that image in my head and just fantasize about what that would have looked like. So in the Alterverse somewhere is a Super Mario Brothers movie in which Bill Murray is King Koopa constantly asking about his pizza. Where's my pizza? Has anyone seen my pizza? Which happens.
What if he were Mario instead of King Koopa? Because you would put him now as King Koopa, but him back then, everyone would want him as Mario.
I would actually want him as Luigi. Because I think, you know, physically he's more of a Luigi type. And I would not want to take Hoskins out of the Mario role. Because again, like the only warm
because
light.
Drunken Bob Hoskins is the best thing about the movie.
He's the only warm light in this dark, dark abyss of a film is Bob Hoskins. And again, this just goes back to what we've been saying over and over and over in the show is no matter what, when you hire Bob Hoskins, you're going to have at least one solid performance in your film. Even if that's just from Bob. Meanwhile, Dennis Hopper is King Koopa, is on so many drugs, I don't think he knows where he is. And it makes the character of Koopa, like, I think they just let him go
with
it.
How is that different from most Dennis Hopper performances?
Because I think they just let him go with it. I don't think they tried to rein him in. He says so many things in this movie that I'm like, are you aware of the film that you're currently in? Or do you think you're still in your trailer popping uppers and downers? Like, what is up, man? And the pizza thing is the best example. Even though he's the most evil man in this dimension and wants to come into our world and, you know, transmorph all of us into lizards, he's concerned about where his pizza is throughout 90% of this film.
I feel like that was a concession on trying to get the kids involved because this is, keep in mind, this is in the era where Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles had exploded and were one of the biggest things on the planet. So you've got reptilians, you got to make them want pizza.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
It feels like that's very much, it feels like that kind of a gimmick.
Yeah, and like I said, this is a movie that doesn't look like Super Mario Brothers, but incorporates things like the bombs and the mushrooms and the platforms and the stomper boots.
But John Leguizamo, who is a very important part of the game.
Yeah, who is – you can play as Mario, Luigi, Peach, Toad, or – John Leguizamo. Super Mario Brothers 2 is a weird game.
As the pest.
Yeah, as the pest. Oh, God. That's even – like, again, testament to how terrible the 90s are. The pest ruins – almost forever, the most dangerous game remake cycle that goes on. And that movie's been remade more than Seven Samurai, but the pest almost ruined that concept for movies forever. And then Mean Guns came along and did the same thing.
Well, let's save Albert Pune for another episode.
The point being that I enjoy Super Mario Brothers, but it may be because I actually saw this movie, you know, when I was still very much playing these games and love these characters. Now, I should have not enjoyed a single frame of it because the way that, like I was saying, the way they incorporate this stuff is it doesn't look like a Mario Brothers movie. And one of the weirdest incorporations is that they turn. Okay, so there's this woman in the film named Big Bertha. She's a giant black bouncer who works at some bar. In the game, Big Bertha was a fish that jumped out of the water and tried to eat Mario. They turned a fish from the game into a giant black woman. That is probably the weirdest, like, video game to movie adaptation casualty is, like, why – if you're – I don't understand this. Why would you even do this? Why did not just leave that character out entirely? Why even make mention of Big Bertha in a movie that, as far as we can tell, has no water in it whatsoever because you're essentially making Alien from L.A. with Mario characters, which is – pretty much what the movie reminds me of.
God, why'd you make me think of the Kathy Ireland movie?
Because that is exactly what Super Mario Brothers is. It's Alien from L.A.
It is Alien from L.A.
with Super Mario Brothers characters. And that is how we're going to end this show.
And I saw them both in a theater, which makes me very sad. It was the 80s and 90s were not as glorious as many of you 90s kids imagine it was.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I do want to just bring this up. This is a little-known fact about Hopkins that was discovered or unearthed actually by The Wrap about 2 years ago. Essentially, what happened was in the early 90s, there was a version of So Chris Claremont, who wrote Dark Phoenix Saga, Days of Future Past, he wrote
X-Men from he created the new X-Men and wrote it for decades.
He pitched the idea of an X-Men film to James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow. Cameron was going to produce, Bigelow was going to direct. So take a minute to think about a James Cameron produced, Catherine Bigelow directed X-Men film.
I remember when this was being talked about, because everybody, all of the comic geeks were excited, because it's like, who would you cast as the X-Men? And that's where everybody started throwing the names around, and the names that were actually getting, you know, it was in that era, you know, is the early 90s, where people are like, you know who'd be a really good Professor Xavier? That guy from Star Trek The Next Generation. Oh, no way, man. You don't want a TV guy playing for – no. I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you, the guy who plays the captain on the new Enterprise, that dude is totally Professor
Xavier.
Wow,
can you imagine a universe where Patrick Stewart is Professor – oh, wait. That's this universe
where the one that everybody wanted
– X-Men movies of future past. That's crazy. Anyway, awesome. Claremont pitched the idea of Bob Hoskins as Wolverine, which – isn't, like, I'm not saying it's apt casting. I am saying I want to see that fucking movie.
Well, it makes sense in terms of, like, especially when you know, we talked about The Long Good Friday. There's that shower scene with Hoskins when he's cleaning the blood off him. And you just see, I mean, he's small of frame, but he's hulking. Like, that's all muscle under there at that era. And, you know, Wolverine as a character, I was bothered by, you know, Hugh Jackman as Wolverine at first. Hugh Jackman is one of the few characters who took a role and actually became more of the character over time, as opposed to moved away from it. Like, if you look at pictures now, he actually looks closer to Wolverine now than he did when he was cast 15 years ago. But the thing with Wolverine that always drove his character, especially in the Claremont era, was that Wolverine was 5'3" tall. He had little man syndrome. He was this angry little guy who would fuck everything up and who you were always scared of and who was always grumpy, but you could count on because he was also dependable. Even though he would take off and leave for months at a time, he would always come back and he'd be there for you, and even if it wasn't in his best interest. And Hoskins, at that time, is kind of perfect for that. And he's small of stature, you know, he's got that anger in him with, you know, imagine that same kind of performance that we've seen in movies we've talked about here, but it's the heroic asshole, you know, not the cool suave way that he was, he was played in the early films, more along the lines of the seething time bomb that we see in the last few films, especially in The Wolverine.
Yeah.
You know, I think Hoskins would have made an interesting movie. Although, you know, having seen the Cameron Spider-Man film from the 90s, I shudder to think what that movie would have actually been about.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, to bring this full circle, Wolverine has that same Napoleonic complex as somebody like Harold from The Long Good Friday. So maybe that would have been a great piece of casting. I'm going to keep imagining a world where that actually existed. And, you know, we're just going to, you know, tip our hats and say farewell to one of, you know, a guy who kind of exemplified my childhood in a lot of really weird ways, like between Hook and Who Framed Roger Rabbit especially, and even Super Mario Brothers. Like these, I mean, you know, say what you want about that film, but those three movies together are such a huge part of my childhood that it really was a big blow for me to learn that he had passed on. And he had retired from acting two years ago when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And you know, it's a real blow. I think the film community has lost a giant, and even if his height doesn't communicate that, the man was a giant.
Yeah. Well, we don't have many tough guys left, and sadly, he was one of the last great tough guys. One of the guys who, when he walked on screen, even like we talked about movies just a few years ago, he's in his late 60s and he's still bringing it hard and heavy. And he was he's one of those guys who's a legend. I mean, he just is, and will continue to be so, and will be one of those guys that we hold with Lee Van Cleef and Lee Marvin and eventually Clint Eastwood as the really great tough guys of cinema past.
The Mafia. I've shit 'em.
And for this week's Junk Food Pairing, in honor of Bob Hoskins, I'm going with the raspberry ripple, which is a flavor of ice cream. There's a quote in Long Good Friday when one of Harold's associates is murdered at a public pool. The maintenance guy tells him that they're going to take the body out in an ice cream truck to be discreet. And Harold replies, there's a lot of dignity in that, isn't there? Going out like a raspberry ripple. And I love that line so much. And I think in a weird way, raspberry ripple, which is basically vanilla ice cream with a raspberry infusion to make vanilla ice cream a little less vanilla, is kind of synonymous with his career, where he would come into movies sometimes that were just plain, sometimes that were terrible, and he would be, you know, that extra flavor that the movie needed to, you know, at least have one bright shining element.
I don't know. I think that we kind of need to pair with scotch and a little more scotch.
We're gonna pour a little out for Bob Hoskins directly into our throats.
Yeah.
And that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema this week. I want to remind you yet again, you can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or individually. I'm at Bragg Salisbury.
I am at Massa Worm.
Yeah, where else can they find you online?
You can find me at facebook.com/massaworm. And next Tuesday, Queen of the Dark Things. So please pre-order that. If you haven't gotten the first book, please pick that up. Dreams and Shadows. Help a brother out. So the new book, Queen of the Dark Things, next Tuesday.
Please go and purchase that. And also, you can find me here at Film School Rejects. You can also find me at oneofus.net, which is a site that I co-founded and manage. And yeah, there's a lot of great podcasts and articles over there. Great stuff to look at every single day. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critics, that remind us of Mr. Hoskins. Good night.